Welcome. Welcome, everyone. My name is Jennifer McGee. I'm the Associate Director of the Lang Center for Civic and Social Responsibility. You are very welcome here today. We have a great crowd. We have students, staff, faculty, community members, some guests from the Uncommon Individual Foundation have joined us here today. So I'm really excited to see all of you and just delighted that you're here with us. Whether through our internship or project grant programs, training or volunteer opportunities, community partnerships, or engaged scholarship, the Lang Center strives to create positive social impact by connecting communities, curriculum, and the campus. The Lang Opportunity Scholarship Program, or LOS for short, is one of the Lang Center's signature programs. It was founded in 1981 through the vision, generosity, and endowment of Eugene M. Lang, class of 38. In years past, Mr. Lang would join the Lang Scholars four times a year for a 7 a.m. breakfast meeting on a Saturday. He loves his Lang Scholars, and he always enjoyed the opportunity to hear about them and their projects. Having been through the dissertation process myself, I would say sometimes those breakfasts felt a bit like a dissertation defense. But at the end of the event, Mr. Lang would come to the point of being teary-eyed, expressing his admiration and respect for the Lang Scholars and all that you've been able to accomplish. So while he's not here today with us in person, he is here with us in spirit, and I just want to just take a minute, let's give him a hand for his incredible vision and generosity. So whether building local capacity for action, providing packages of innovative products and services, or building a social movement, the LOS program has made it possible for Lang Scholars to collectively provide social value to thousands of people in hundreds of communities around the world. Here today, you will hear from some of these social change makers: Tyler Alexander, Raven Bennett, Bolu Fakoya, and Seti Werlenyo. These Lang Scholars demonstrate what it means to be socially responsible, civically engaged, and committed to innovating on behalf of the public good. As the Lang Scholar Advisor, I've been personally moved and inspired by these Lang Scholars, and I'm certain that once their presentations begin, you will understand why. Combined, they have committed 2,250 hands-on hours towards their projects, all the while being student workers, athletes, members of political, religious, cultural, and social groups on campus, as well as full-time students at Swarthmore College, which is no small feat. After each individual scholar presents, we'll have time for maybe one or two questions, and then after everyone's finished, we can open it up for a more broader discussion at the end. So with that, I'll invite Tyler Alexander to start us off. Thank you, Tyler.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. I appreciate it. If anybody can't hear me, say something. So my name is Tyler Alexander. I'm a senior Lang Scholar. And the past 3 or 4 years, I did some work in Haiti. I'm going to be speaking a little bit about that. But before I talk, I'd like to, one, thank Jennifer and thank everybody else on this program for support. And you're going to hear a lot of stuff about what I did, what Bolu did, and everybody else did. That's you know, wonderful. We all, I think, did great work. But what's also really important is this talk is for a lot of people out there, like yourselves or other people, who may not have necessarily been directly involved in the work, but could also be influenced. Because the real part of social change is when we all collectively work. So with that said, keep that in mind. If you take away, you know, anything from this presentation, it doesn't have to be what I did on August 30th in 2015. It should be that, you know, let's try to spread these ideas. Because this is about a lot more than just just this, it's about, you know, being a global community. Great. So let me move on here. So the first thing that I asked myself when I was doing this learning project is I said, do all lives matter? And I think that if you ask anybody the answer, yeah, sure, well, of course all lives matter. I think we can pretty unanimously answer that. Then the second question I asked, if you probe a little bit further, is do all lives matter? I think on the surface, a lot of people would say, yes, all lives matter. But then you ask, you know, how's your son or daughter? Oh, they're the most important person in my life. And then you get this kind of stratification of equality and what it means to be important. And so I kind of pondered this question, do all lives matter equally? On the surface, it seems like a really simple question, but when you look at today's world, it's not such a simple question. And so what I invite you to do, and what I did, not for too long of a time, but I asked this question, okay, who would people say matters more? A firefighter or a gardener? I think a lot of people would say, well, you know, a firefighter, you know, saves lives and blah, blah, blah. Maybe the firefighter matters more. And then, you know, the philosophical people would say, well, and wait, and maybe not give an answer. Or maybe give an answer and say that. But remember, these people have matters. You think they're the most important. And it goes on and on and on. There's no one right answer is what I'm trying to say. So this idea that a life can be more important than another life, we need to get rid of it. And what we need to do is start thinking that all lives matter, whether it's a firefighter or a garbage person or someone, you know, across the country or across the world. And so this is kind of what I went with this project.
So
What I tried to do was a systems thinking approach, and essentially what that means is I incorporated a lot of different methods of solving this problem. Okay, all lives should matter, but they don't, particularly related to health. And I incorporated a lot of different ideas. And what I really stumbled upon was, and focused on, was why are people being treated unequally, and what can I do? I thought what was pretty interesting, someone who inspired me, a lot of people inspired me. One person who really inspired me was Dr. Paul Farmer. I'm not sure if anybody knows him, but he's done a lot of work in the health-related field. And after reading some of his work and thinking about, okay, what did Paul Farmer do, and what could I do, what I started thinking of was, we live in this society, in this world, where we think in order for someone to succeed, someone else needs to be, you know, brought there. But that's not true, right? There's no reason that one person, in order to do well, somebody else has to do for it. It's okay for two people to do well. And so what I did with this idea about healthcare is I started focusing on CPR training in Haiti, in a developing world where health inequality was pretty prevalent, and I felt that people deserve better care, just because all people deserve to be treated equally. Right here you'll see an image of a rural area in Deschapel, Haiti, and this is a cute Haitian baby. I thought that, you know, maybe make some people smile. So what we did, and I'll explain these pictures, I always think this is a funny picture, is I worked with two hospitals in Haiti, and we developed a CPR training program. The real key of this was I asked these questions about health inequality. And I didn't propose a solution and say, you have to do this, but I communicated with the Lang Center and with the resources that we had and was able to provide a service or something that the hospitals were looking for. In this case, two hospitals were looking for CPR training. So I worked with a couple of doctors and hospital administrators, and we developed a CPR training protocol. And we trained, you know, hospital staff, nurses, and EMTs in CPR. And we even went a little bit further in doing, so this is the CPR part. You can see a little bit in there. And we even went a little bit further and started talking about ECG readings, electrocardiography. We got doctors involved and started training nurses and also emerging doctors, giving them more exposure. So this is me being a patient the ECG reading and the laptop is right there, and there's a bunch of people crowded around. So this is the team at one of the hospitals we worked with, a group of nurses, who myself and others trained for about 7 months. And we set up this sustainable program where, you know, people started to become trained. So we had a train-the-trainer approach, and that's still going on. The next thing that I was able to do with the Lang program is to set up this mass casualty preparedness program. And so after CPR, for about 2 years, it was successful, but one of the components that was missing was this infrastructure. We could resuscitate somebody, but the infrastructure wasn't necessarily there to sustain a patient after resuscitation. So I communicated with the hospital again, and we thought that this was great what we had done with CPR, but we could do more. We had more time and more resources, and Jennifer was very supportive, and a lot of other people were very supportive. And so what I did from midway through 2015 to now, that's still going on, is work with Hospital Brinard Meps in Port au Prince, Haiti, to set up a mass casualty incident preparedness program. And so for people who don't know what that is, essentially something like the earthquake, a disaster of any sort that ravages a hospital and overruns its resources, the hospital needs a program or a protocol for how to respond. Kind of like you wake up really late after like your alarm goes off and you keep snoozing it, and then you wake up and realize like you have to get somewhere. So instead of rushing to find your keys and like your ties over your shoulder and trying to do it as you get out to the car to make it on time, you need a system that could support this and save lives. And so since 2015, I started working on this, and since the earthquake, the hospital didn't have a protocol in place. This is the largest trauma center in the state, and they still haven't had a protocol in place. So it's not some small hospital. It's the most advanced and largest trauma center. So what we did is we developed a program to train individuals in order to respond to disasters. It was awesome. It was really cool. People were really excited about this, and we had a lot of participation. So I'll show some pictures. So here's one picture. Here's another picture. These are all doctors and nurses and administrators, and you can see people are pretending to be really sick and collapsing in each other's arms, and it was a really, really awesome experience. But even more than that, it was really beneficial. The hospital was really happy to have this training. This is the team that was trained. It was about 16, 17. You couldn't get everybody for the picture. Doctors and nurses, surgeons, EMTs, administrators, you name it, anybody who's part of the hospital who could serve a role in this program got in. And we had people with different roles, different sheets, learning what to do. With the Lang Center, we were able to offer supplies. keep in mind this isn't, you know, just me, this is hospital staff, Swarthmore College, everybody else who helped out. And what was pretty awesome was right after this training, Hurricane Matthew hit, about 2 months after we finished the training. And we've been running through simulations and whatnot, and this program is still ongoing. You know, simulations, they meet once every month and twice every month. Studies show that, you know, that leads to an effective response. Part of it is just keeping up with the training. And we run simulations to deal with hurricanes and to deal with disasters. And before this, they had nothing. 2 months after this, Hurricane Matthew hit, the hospital did an awesome job. The CMO, or the CEO, Chief Medical Officer of the hospital right here, was interviewed on NPR. She said, you know, we had the best response. We're well prepared. They published a report after. Everything went really smoothly. And so that was really rewarding to see this project. So
with that said, in the interest of time and to let everybody else go,
I'd like to thank Mr. Lang for setting up this scholarship and still letting this run, and letting people like myself and all the other Lang scholars and younger Lang scholars continue this mission of creating some sustainable change. And before I take questions, I'd just like to say that, again, remember that change starts with us, especially our generation. And the younger generation going forward, it's always going to be, you know, moving downward to progress. And so what we really need to do is keep this question that all lives matter in mind. And it's not just one program or whatever, you know, other program that someone may do, but it's this ideology and this thought that we need to say, people don't need to suffer because somebody else does well. And once we start spreading this, then I think we'll see lasting change on a global scale. So this is just one small part of, I hope, what can be a larger project facilitated by everybody else to raise the quality of healthcare globally and provide better care. So thank you very much. So Raven is going to be talking about her project now and all the awesome work she's been doing. So I'll introduce Raven and turn it over to her and let her take this over. So thank you.
So thank you for that introduction, Tyler. Can everyone hear me? I guess I can do the same thing. So first off, I just want to extend my eternal gratitude to Mr. Lang, because he has, with this program that he's created and endowed, he has changed the lives of every scholar that's participated, as well as created that network of impact that comes from each individual scholar. And so his work is incredible, and I consider him a role model and a really important factor person in my life. So we've spent all of this time on these projects, and it's really hard to begin to explain what the experience is like. And so just to give you a taste, I tried to break it down to numbers. So we have, for my project alone, 846 days of work, 90 participants, aged 14 to 22, 21 training sessions that I organized, a 10-week internship, 5 community partners, 2 programs, 1 mission, and you're going to throw in there as well 1 thesis, because my honors thesis is also on my project. So there was one motivating statistic for me that led me to this project, and that statistic is 1 in 6. 1 in 6 women will be the target of an attempted or complete sexual assault rape in her lifetime. And so if you look at this room, say there are about 54 people, half of us are women, that's 4.5 women in this room. And I'm one of those women. So I personally was sexually assaulted, I was raped on campus my freshman year. And first I was very sad and scared. And then I was angry. And then I was passionate. And I was motivated. And I said, this happened to me for a reason. I have to do something about this. I also want to add, doing further research, I want to add to this number, men and people of other genders are also sexually assaulted. Also, if you look at the statistic, people of color and queer people are sexually assaulted at higher rates as well. So I just want to acknowledge that. Okay, so empowerment. I wanted to think of a way that people could engage with this issue and feel like they could handle it. It's such a difficult issue. It's such a heavy issue. It's an issue that touches all of us. And I wanted to engage with people in a way that didn't leave them feeling depressed and despondent, but left them feeling like they could do something about it. And that idea came from my, actually, psychology professor, who is my thesis advisor, who told us one day in class, people can handle bad news and difficult things if they feel like they can do something about it. So that's really the motivating theory behind all my projects. So I felt like from the beginning that I wanted to go back to my community. I'm from Los Angeles, particularly Santa Monica, and work with them because youth in that community, because I didn't feel like I got as much information about sexual assault and sexual assault prevention as I would have liked to, and so I really wanted to go back to my community and make an impact. And so the Youth Activist Institute was born. And this is a collaboration between myself and the UCLA Rape Treatment Center and the Santa Monica Police Activities League, and it was a 10-day program that was very intensive. We had 28 young people join us, and it was really transformative. We started at the fundamentals. What is gender? What are the boxes that we're put into because of our gender? And how does that influence the way that we act in the world and interact with others? Then we moved into how that connects to sexual violence and how to identify sexual violence, be an active bystander against it, and then also support our friends and ourselves if we find that we are targets of sexual violence or our friends are targets of sexual violence. We also incorporated a self-care unit because we wanted to really, you know, we recognize these are young people and this is a difficult topic and we want to support them emotionally as well. And originally, you know, it's called a Youth Activist Institute. So I envisioned these students going out into the world and doing their own projects. And as I worked with them, I sort of found that their developmental stage may not have lent them to do such sort of self-directed individual work without more infrastructure. And so while in this iteration, they weren't able to go forth and do projects, we really did emphasize ways that they as individuals and their individual reactions or interactions could make change. And I'd say in future iterations, I'd be really motivated to find ways to create the infrastructure for them to do programs. So let's talk about some of the outcomes. We achieved our goal, which was to increase participant knowledge about gender stereotypes, consent, sexual assault, victim survivor support, and all of those were increased at the end of the program compared to the beginning. Some of the other measures of success that I saw were qualitative measures, and that is, for example, one girl on the last day cried, and I said, why are you crying? And she was like, I don't want it to be over. And I say at the beginning of the project, I could never have imagined that there would be young people who wouldn't want to stop talking about sexual violence and preventing sexual violence. So that indicates to me that there was some kind of transformative action that took place. So after this project, I guess I'm especially frugal and good at saving money because I had more funds. And I said, let's keep this going. Let's push this out. Let's extend impact. How can we take this idea and take it to another community, take the same theory of empowerment? And you know, my other community that means a lot to me is Swarthmore. And actually, Al Brooks, who was a Lang Scholar, a recent alum, approached me one day and said, hey, I'm part of Phi Psi, I'm on the exec board. Would you be willing to come and train the exec board on how to do a training in the house for the brothers? And so I trained those brothers and we had conversations and they said, that went really well, but we think the conversation needs to keep going. And so I kept engaging in dialogue with them, and at one point the Phi Psi president said to me, you know, I have brothers coming in, high schoolers coming in, and I feel like they're not at the same knowledge level in terms of campus culture as other students. What if we made a mentorship program for them? And I said, that's a great idea, let's do it. And so the fraternity mentorship program was born. And as I mentioned, this is my thesis. So I actually had a treatment group and a control group. And the treatment group did 5 sexual violence prevention trainings, as well as a mentorship component where older brothers and younger brothers, incoming pledges, were paired up and met at least once a week for an hour for the entire semester to talk about these issues. Then the control group did the sexual violence prevention trainings without the mentorship component. And we found that participation in the mentorship program resulted in greater positive changes in attitudes related to male sexual violence fitting behaviors, which essentially means that the mentorship program made more attitude change. And there's also this quote, because I like to balance the quantitative and qualitative data. And one of the brothers said, like a lot of guys in the fraternity, I came from a conservative high school. This experience, which he means the program, has made me overall more aware and conscious person. And I recently had a reflection with all the brothers, and we continue to have dialogue, and they said, like, we need to continue this program. We feel like we've made progress, and continuing this program will be really important to maintaining and increasing that progress. And so in terms of this program right now, I'm actually looking at ways to scale it up and continue it here, as well as extend it out into different campuses. And I'm really excited about that possibility. Thanks for listening. I'm Raven, and that was my...
So now I'm excited to bring up a fellow Lang scholar and incredible person, Bolu.
So, hi. I'm going to move the mouse away. I'm Bolu. I am a senior. I'm a bio and social science double major. And I'm here to talk to you today about my Lang project, which is the Abuja Science and Community Resource Center. I struggled for a bit about the best way to relay this information to you. We've been through a lot of revisions, a lot of change, and a lot of impactful growth, and I thought I would just inundate you with my logic model and like make you walk through everything that we have been refining over the past 2.5 years. But then I thought, no, let's do this another way. So let's start at the beginning. I am Nigerian. I'm an international student. This is where I'm from, and it's where my family lives. And my project is based here in Abuja, which is right in the heart of Nigeria. Abuja is one of the largest cities in Nigeria. It's rapidly growing, one of the fastest growing in the world. And it's got all these really cool communities inside it, and they're so very different. It's a very diverse city. It is absolutely beautiful. It is surrounded by parks and nature and wildlife, and that plays a really key role in my project, which I'll come back to later. And finally, Abuja, as I mentioned, is very diverse. It is a very religious city, and what happens is that, unfortunately, as is in many parts of the world, religion and ethnic affiliation can play a huge role in educational attainment. And so we went to the drawing board and said, what can we do? What is a social problem and how can we address it? In particular, I wanted to find ways to engage within education. And so let's look at education in Abuja. There are some really quality education resources available in Abuja, such as high schools, but they tend to be very much locked away in the international high schools that aren't available to the wider public and to the people who are looking for this sort of education, especially young people in the city. Then we looked at science. I'm a bio major. I'm a big fan of STEM. And once again, there are one or two resources available in the city, but they're also sort of not available to the people who are looking to access them, the young people in the city who are very excited about this sort of stuff. And finally, the idea of community. As I mentioned, Abuja is made up of these smaller sort of neighborhoods, but people, when we conducted our initial surveys, weren't finding ways to interact with this community and to really get involved. And so we wanted to find a project that would sort of break down those barriers and get kids involved in the community. So I went back to the drawing board again and said, how can we address all of these through an education approach? And the first thing we did was talk to students. We conducted surveys and focus groups and said, what are you looking for in an educational program and opportunity? And we conducted surveys, we met with students in schools and out of schools, and really got a comprehensive picture of what they wanted to do. Then we talked to teachers, because teachers have been doing this for a very long time, institutional memory of the highest order. And I didn't want any point in time to feel like we were competing with the teachers. We wanted to supplement what they were doing, do it in conjunction with them, so that they were, so we could engage with them at a deeper level and really get a lot of value out of it. We wanted to work on areas of strength. My project uses an appreciative inquiry model, which looks at areas that students are working very well and that they're passionate about. Because we feel if we can support those, the skills they learn in doing those will transfer to other parts of their lives and the education. And so we came up with STEM. Abuja has some really some students who are really excited about STEM education who really want to learn more about science and technology. So we started developing curricula, and we started talking to faculty here at Swarthmore to find ways to engage with these students and get this knowledge going. And we were to go out and start doing it and start the program. But then we went back to the drawing board and rehashed it because we wanted to center this all around critical thinking. It's important in STEM, it's important in all kinds of education, being able to look at a concept, break it down, and find different points of interaction with it. In particular, in the idea of research. Research is a really important component of STEM because not only is it encouraging students to go out there and learn new things, it's encouraging them to go out there, learn things, and apply them in a different situation, especially in their communities. So that's how the ASCRC was formed, the Abuja Science and Community Resource Center, which is a STEM-centered resource center which runs critical thinking workshops, scientific writing workshops, and also promotes student-led research projects. That's me, building. So I'm going to walk you through what each of these steps mean and what it has been able to do in the community so far. So the STEM-centered resource center, these kids are really excited about STEM education and they really like science. We talked to the teachers and they said they've been really passionate about their biology, chemistry, physics classes, so we wanted to support that. So we started organizing library. We have a library section of the center, but also providing computers and technology that they can be able to come to after school and look up topics that they're interested in, learn more. What's really important is that we're using Nigerian examples in our training modules. It's really important that these students can see how these principles of STEM work out in their own local context, which is really important. The second thing was critical thinking workshops. We designed entire modules that encourage students, these are all aged between 14 and 18, students to really begin to engage with critical thinking as a way of learning. As I mentioned earlier, Abuja is a very religious city, and so what we wanted to do was ensure that in all our cohorts, we've had two so far, each of eight students, we had an equal representation of men and women, because that's really important, especially as we think about how Nigeria is growing in the future and engaging with modern dynamics. With scientific writing workshops, I'm a writing associate here at Swarthmore, and I love teaching writing. I love the idea of being able to work through someone through the thinking process as shown through their writing. And if anyone's ever done science before, you know that writing and communicating science effectively is a really key skill that a lot of people have, but it's really important to nurture. So we did all of those. And finally, we went to the student-led research projects. These students took what they had learned in the center, went out into the communities, did research projects, and came back and presented them. And so we had some students doing work on internet penetration in rural communities. We had students doing work of reading of primary literature and then explaining that to everyone around them. We had students looking at waste disposal and aquatic life, and that's Toby, and he was here presenting his work to us over the summer. So we were very excited to see what's happening. Students learning principles about science, going into the community, answering questions that they saw, and coming back and presenting them to the wider community. A fifth part that I didn't tell you about, but is really important, are the field trips and community outreach. I mentioned before, these students saw that they lived within these communities, but didn't have many ways to interact with them outside of school. And so we organized field trips to the planetarium and to the Space Center to see examples of Nigerian science in action. Nigeria has satellites. We have them going up around giving us weather information, but none of the students knew that. So we took them to the planetarium so they could really get ideas of how they could begin to engage their skills as scientists and as researchers in a Nigerian context. To celebrate World Environment Day, we also teamed up with a local primary school and planted trees with the students to really encourage principles in environmental conservation and being aware of the effects that our human actions are having on the really beautiful environment of Abuja that I showed earlier. So, I actually walked you through all of this, but like I broke it down, so yeah. But then what I also like to realize is that this scholarship is not just so much a project, but also me as an individual. It's been tied to the work I do here at Swarthmore as a bio and social major, the summers that I spent, the internships that I've done, and the really cool relationships I've built with people like Jan, and also like Sede, whose project is also STEM-centered, another fellow Lang scholar of mine. So where are we going forward with this project? The first thing we're going to do is we're going to revise a project. This summer is going to be spent reflecting on what's been done and going back to the curriculum and making changes that need to be made based on what the students have told us. The second thing we're going to do is we're going to recruit and expand. We've been working with volunteers from local high schools as well as teachers, but through spotlight sessions, we've got the idea of being able to recruit from universities, students who are majoring in STEM who want to find ways to teach, and so working with them to sort of include them in our model, and also working with program alums. We have 16 alums who have been through the program, who really enjoyed it. Are there ways they want to come back and begin working with other students who are working through the ASCRC? finally want to expand the project. We've been working primarily with one secondary school in Abuja. We've received offers from other schools who want to implement our program in their STEM education. And I mentioned that the project is centered here in Abuja. We received an offer from the library project in Uyo, which is in the south of Nigeria, who wants to incorporate this model into their library project and expand it as we grow. I finally want to repeat it. I want to go, I've had two cohorts so far. I want to keep doing this again. It's been really impactful and really important, and we're happy to see the progress we've made. But that's the project, and I feel like it's very hard to separate the project from what I've been doing and what I want to do post-Whitmore. So I'm here, and I'm going to be doing science for the next 6 years. I'm going to be getting my graduate degree in microbiology, and then I'm going to teach science. I think it's really important. It's a really fun way to get involved and engage with students and think about how science can be applied to principles of community engagement and responsibility. With that, I'd like to thank some of my wonderful co-facilitators and the students that we've been working with. The secondary school we've been partnering with so far, which is Nadella, an NGO that we've been partnering with to provide support, as well as ways to advertise our work in the Abuja community, and find the Lang Center for all they've been able to do so far. And with that, thanking Mr. Lang, I'd like to take any questions you may have.
Good afternoon, everybody. How are you doing?
Good.
Yeah, so my name is Selina Wolanyo, and I just wanted to start by thanking you for being here. I see like some of my professors who I met at my AVAL, and I was so excited to see their faces. They have no idea. Okay, so I'm going to start off by telling you about this song in Ghana. So there's a patriotic song in Ghana titled Yenara Asasini. And the song talks about how the way that Ghana as a nation can prosper is dependent on the behavior of the citizens, the character of the citizens, and the skills that they have. And this was a song I learned when I was 7 years old, but the message stuck with me. Yenara means our very own, translated in tree in Ghana. And this theme of our very own has run through my entire song of education. Growing up, when I looked at different problems in the community and I looked at solutions in the community, I would see that a lot of the solutions were from external sources. And it was important to me that throughout my sophomore education, through the classes that I took, through the clubs I was involved in, through my special major, and just through my line project, I was going to equip myself with critical thinking skills, problem solving skills, that would enable me to think about homegrown solutions, solutions that would be for Ghanaians, from Ghanaians as well, and make that sustainable. So that's how my project, Yenara Adobe Robotics, was kind of born as well. So that's me smiling in the middle. And Yenara Robotics is it was a robotics workshop that I held over the summer with students from Adobe Senior High School in the central region of Ghana. And it was targeted at improving critical thinking, problem-solving skills, and increasing the students to STEM in a hands-on, practical, and fun way. So where is Odome? So Odome, like I mentioned, is in the central region of Ghana, and it's a village that my grandmother grew up in. I grew up in the capital of Ghana, which is Accra. But I would spend a lot of my holidays, I would spend a lot of the weekends with my grandmother in the village, and it was great because it was an opportunity where I could get to know the people and get to love the community that she grew up in. And as a result of that, when I was thinking about my land project and the community I wanted to work with, Odobing was the first community in my mind. It's a village where there's one main senior high school, and that's the school that I work with. So what happened was, over winter break, my team had a community assessment where we went to the school, we talked to the headmistress, we talked to different members of administration, staff, and we talked to 30 students who were in first year classes, second year classes as well, in the senior high school. And our findings revealed that a lot of the students learned through rote memorization, and this is something that you see typically in like, a lot of senior high schools in Ghana, where if I asked, for example, what is a computer? You would have everybody in the class saying the same line that their teacher gave them. So regurgitating the information that they had learned and not necessarily applying critical thinking skills or problem solving skills. So that's what my project sought to address.
And the way it worked was we had two main phases. So we had the teacher training phase and the student phase, where with the teacher training phase, we worked with three teachers. Initially, the idea was to work with three teachers to do the training, but what happened was when I got there on the day, we had six teachers turn up because they had heard about robotics and were curious and were interested and they wanted to know what exactly this girl from sophomore college was going to be showing. So we had the teacher training session where the teachers worked with us to assemble the robots, to build them, put the parts together, and then we had a programming phase where they learned how to program the robots. With that, we had the teachers work with us in the next phase, where it was transferring that knowledge to the students. And it was interesting because it was interesting seeing the outcomes. We worked with 25 girls in the school. And for example, one of my students, Millicent, in the beginning of the program, she wouldn't say a word, like she wouldn't talk in class at all. And it was interesting to see how she evolved over time and how her confidence came over time. And when I went over winter break and I was speaking to the other teachers, I hear that her participation in all other classes has greatly improved. So that was one outcome that was unexpected, that it was interesting to see through robotics. Another thing was when the first year of the class, when the students were learning how to assemble together the different parts of the robots, they were initially scared to even touch the robotics pads to begin with because it was technology that they hadn't been exposed to. And it was interesting seeing the difference between them in the beginning where they wouldn't even touch the pads to them going from not touching the pads to like trying to put them together and then finally having a robot in their hand and being proud of what they had assembled and put together. So that was very valuable. In addition to that, there was a lot of team building, teamwork that went on, and it was great to see how the students learned how to work together as a team. As part of the robotics program, we wanted to prepare them with team building exercise. So we had design thinking workshops, we had various team building exercises, and that was enough preparation for them to think about how they could think about solving problems within their community. Now, what was the outcome on me? So I found that my confidence as well greatly increased. I remember telling Lisa is one of my mentors here at Swarthmore, and I remember wondering like how professors at Swarthmore do it, like how are they so great at like teaching? Because I remember trying to teach and I thinking, wow, like I need to like slow down and like make sure I reach all the students in a specific way. And it was difficult, and I found that I had evolved over time, and then my teaching and facilitation had also improved, and my team members and co-facilitators as well noticed that. Swarthmore has been helpful as a resource. From my classes, the classes that I took, I did an independent study, again with Lisa McGinn, and it was a study that allowed me to do research on what robotics was, what people were using it for, and how it was being applied to critical thinking skills as well. Additionally, I had the opportunity to visit Walnut Elementary School in Upper Derby, where they were doing robotics workshops as well. And I got that connection again from my professors here at Swarthmore. So the independent study was helpful in shaping how I thought about my project. In addition to that, speaking to people like Jennifer and McGee as well, brainstorming and just having an idea of how I wanted to think about my project and how I wanted to implement it through my professors was helpful. Now, this is an online course I built. It's a course that takes a curriculum that I designed, and it shows people who, if you're thinking about implementing a robotics workshop, you'd be able to go through the course, start the course, see why robotics, see the lessons that you can develop from the lessons you can learn, and then also how to make it sustainable and scalable. So that brings me to reflections and lessons that I learned. Going into the program, initially I didn't realize the value of icebreakers. I was gonna just go and then go through programming, go through the building. But then I realized how the icebreakers were essential in having the students get to know each other, get to know one another, and get to know the mentors and the volunteers that are part of the program. And that was one valuable lesson. Additionally,
one takeaway was the relationships that I built through the program. I would never have imagined getting to know the students on such a personal level, getting to know them one-on-one, hearing about their families, hearing about the things that they had to do outside of school. And I was only able to build that relationship and invest in those relationships because other people had invested in me as well. Yeah, it's a lot more. And yeah, just reflecting on my line experience, I'm just immensely grateful to all the support systems that I've had here as well. From all the people in the room, I can see some faces and I'm like smiling at them. But yeah, my professors and the classes I'm taking have definitely influenced how I think about problems in my community and how I want to go for it and make a change as well. But yeah, thank you for your time.